Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 3rd, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, and then a discussion with Chris Martinson, scientist, entrepreneur, and publisher of the internet sensation, The Crash Course, on why the future is going to be remarkably different than the past and how to make that work for you. Our theme tonight is Remember the Pillsbury Doughboy. I haven't had a TV since 1984, but before then there used to be commercials where somebody would squeeze down on the Pillsbury Doughboy, so you'd squeeze and, you know, down on one part and he'd pop out in the other part, the dough would pop out. And the financial system is remarkably like the Pillsbury Doughboy. When you squeeze down in one place, something pops out in the other place. When I ran Hamilton Securities Group in Washington, we used to have a group of people who were remarkable at seeing the financial ecosystem as one whole thing that wove throughout all politics and the whole economy, you know, both local and global. And something, somebody would come in and say, oh, interest rates just went up 50 basis points, and they'd say, oh, well, such and such is going to happen. And it would infuriate the others who didn't look at the thing as a dynamic ecosystem, because they'd say, well, you know, what do mortgage rates have to do with, you know, politics on the Appropriation Committee? You know, there's no connection. They saw the world in sort of different slices and dices and not so much connected. And one of my goals as the Solari Report is to help you see those connections. And, of course, the connections we're watching and we've been watching all this week, and it's theming in the news. Everybody's getting an education. Currency debasement drives up commodity prices, which means it drives up food and energy prices, some of the most basic costs of a household or a business, which then pops out into financial and political change all over the planet, whether in your household or my household or your in countries around the world. I'm speaking to you tonight from the book publishing company at the farm in Summertown, Tennessee. It's one of my favorite places and one of my favorite groups of people in the world. A group came from San Francisco in the 70s and started an intentional community in Summertown. It's quite beautiful, and they do many things here, but one of the things they did early on, was in 1974, I think, was they created a publishing company. They called it the Book Publishing Company, and really to publish the books that told the story of what they were doing and how they were sort of inventing their healthy lifestyle. And they're one of the leaders on food books, fresh food, raw food, vegetarian food. Needless to say, the people at the farm eat very, very well. Now, those of you who know me know that I make a real effort to buy very fresh, healthy, organic food when I go road tripping. So if I have a 2 or 3 day trip, I have a cooler full of things so that I don't have to buy along the road. Well, suffice it to say, I left Pennsylvania in very dire weather earlier this week, and I, for a variety of reasons, I ended up not doing that and instead ate along the road. By the time I got to, woke up in a motel in Virginia, I looked like I'd been in a prize fight. I'm not used to eating that kind of food. I finally got to the farm here in Tennessee and just had for dinner a lentil soup that was so fantastic. But it was a reminder of how much harder it is to get fresh and really high-quality food and the importance of being able to provide that for yourself. And that's what we talked about in the year-end wrap-up, and that's gonna be a theme I'm going to keep bringing up again and again in this report and this year, because it's so, so important. Well, change is upon us, and change is upon Solari, too. We announced this week that Solari Silver and Gold is going to shift to a consultancy from a gold and silver dealership. We think gold and silver continue to be excellent investments. We're very happy to be in that business. But what we're learning from our customers, which includes some of you, is that you really prefer to deal with a money changer or a range of dealers, and what you want from us is an honest opinion. And so switching to a consultancy makes an awful lot of sense. Now, the Solari Silver and Gold customers will continue to get our volume discounts will be recognized by the money changer. Paul and I are available at no charge by appointment if you have questions about your holding or need to sell. So just in that sense, pretend as though we're still a dealership. We're still here to support you if you've been purchasing from us. More change, our Facebook's space came down, or my Facebook space came down, we kept having hackers log in on an unauthorized basis and do very creative things, and then send invitations out to my list in very irritating ways, including me. You can imagine what it's like to get a invitation to join your own Facebook page. That's perfect. Perfect word for it. Anyway, so finally, it was just too painful. We just had to take it down. Another great change, Dina Rivers. We're going to welcome Dina Rivers to the Salia Report team. She's going to be helping us as we launch our new blog with a private space just for subscribers and preparing transcripts for the Salia Reports, which will make it easier for you to selectively listen to files and to also post comments and questions. I was hoping to have the year-end wrap-up transcript for tonight, but we'll have it for next week, and I really think that will be very useful to you. Now, I'm back in Tennessee. This is the period of the year where I huddle down in the investment advisory and financial world. It's sort of the period when you deal with regulation compliance, how you did last year, what your outlook is for the next year. So what I'm noticing as I do it is all the banks, financial institutions, big and small banks, insurance companies, mortgage operations have huge new regulation and compliance as a result of the financial reform bill. So we're all huddled down for the first quarter. And my entire focus is building family wealth. How do you build family wealth in this kind of environment? Come springtime, I expect to be back on the road, and you know I'm going to be back at the National Bank of Malvern, where I've been for the last two and a half months. Those bankers, I never thought that frugality and honest dealing could be so sexy and so much fun, but there it is. It can be done. Anyway, so springtime, back out on the road. Money and markets. Ed Sullivan used to have an expression saying, this is really, really big. This is going to be really, really big. If there's one story you need to pay attention to and understand is so much bigger than anything else you're listening to, seeing on the news this week, it's this. Social Security has turned negative permanently, or permanently for the foreseeable future. Social Security has for decades been a cash flow generator for the federal government. Social Security monies get paid in, and the amount that goes out is less, and the surplus buys treasury. So you're financing government operations. So that low-income housing tax grant that somebody next door got, that was financed with your Social Security payments. Well, during the 2008 financial crisis, Social Security turned negative, but the, you know, sort of the spin was, oh, it was going to go back positive until it started to go negative, 2015 or so. No, that's not what the Congressional Budget Office now says. We're now expecting a $45 billion deficit for 2011. We have 10,000 baby boomers retiring every year, every day. And so what we're seeing is red ink for the foreseeable future. Now, the extent to which this radically changes the politics of the elderly and of Social Security and the federal budget cannot be stressed enough. And in combination with computer voting, it means that the elderlies go from being a constituency that has enormous political clout to a constituency which is a major political liability. And so we're about to see very, very big change. I talked in the last Larry report about Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont being concerned that the White House wouldn't affirm that Social Security changes were off the table. Now, what we've seen with Obama and what we're watching worldwide, and I suspect this is part of what we're watching in Egypt, is a moving out of leaders who have commitments to the older generation and a moving in of leaders who are younger. And that makes it fashionable to cut commitments to the older generation globally. And this is not just going to be U.S. This is going to be U.S., Europe. This is going to be a global phenomenon. Now, as I said, we're exporting inflation. The central bank has been doing QE2. We now have the Kansas City Fed president talking about the possibility of a QE3. So we're printing money, and that inflation gets exported globally, and it's hitting the commodities markets all around the world. We have in January, I talked in the year-end wrap-up about how much commodities were up for the year. But in January alone, after those extraordinary price rises, we see corn up 7, almost 8%, rice up 10%, sugar up almost 6%, orange up 3%, cotton up 17%. What this means is food and basic necessities around the world are going up, and of course that's part of what we've seen in the coverage of the problems in Tunisia and Egypt. The IMF is then going around behind the scenes pushing to cut food and oil subsidies, which simply exacerbates the inflation and creates the more dependency on the centralized controlled markets. We're also seeing it in rural USA. I've been gone from Tennessee and rural Tennessee for about 6 months. I've been amazed. I drove through places in the last 2 days that looked like they've been hit by a nuclear war. So currency debasement can be extraordinary. Bill Gross, the head of PIMCO, huge bond fund manager, has a new piece out called The Devil's Bargain. Bill Gross is usually sort of fronting for the tapeworm, but he had this to say. He says, money has become the economic and political wedge for profound changes in American society. That's true. Perhaps the most deceptive policy tool to lessen debt loads is the negative or exceedingly low real interest rate that central banks impose on savers and debt holders. It's true. This is absolutely punishing those who save in dollars, which describes a lot of rural America. But it rewards those who save in tangible. So those of you who started saving in precious metals a decade ago, you've been protected. So record price index. Now, that makes the U.S. equity markets look attractive because they're holding their nominal values. They're not holding their purchasing prices. One of the challenges has been how do you get the equity market to perform in this environment? I just want to tell you a little insight I had sitting in Mitch's gym in Westchester this week. At the beginning of the year, International Living, which is a trade magazine that specializes in helping people find low-cost places to live abroad, had as their lead article that the number one most attractive place to live in 2011 was going to be the United States. I said, oh, this is very interesting. And then Barron's came out with a series of pieces on their big sort of 2011 outlook predicting that the domestic markets would be the strong place, despite the fact that everybody's trying to get their capital shifted into the emerging markets, and predicted that the big large cap stocks would be the place to be. Then I was up in New York over the holidays, and it was the same thing. Everybody was beating the drums. Domestic stock market was going to be high. The large cap domestic stocks are going to do great. I thought, how are they going to do this? You know, there's some real challenges. How do you keep corporate profits up in the face of rising costs and unemployment? As of December 2010, 30% of the 14 million people in America who were unemployed had been jobless for a year or more. That translates into about 4.2 million, and that's the highest it's been since World War II. Well, so I'm sitting in Mitch's gym on the treadmill watching the 20 TV screens, and on about four or five talking heads are on the morning shows talking about, oh, food prices are going up, the Egyptian stock market's down 8%, this is what's going to happen to the emerging markets around the world, you want your money to come back to the domestic market. And I thought, oh, God, the boys are so good at this. Anyway, what we've been watching in Egypt is quite a media fest. We put up two videos, one from William Egdahl, another from Webster Tarpley, talking about the extent to which we're watching manipulations, encouraging the protesters, financing the protesters, all of which I suspect is probably true in one form or another. The disrespect the United States has shown to a sovereign government is pretty shocking. Telling a president he has to resign before the next election is hardly, well, you don't even know what to say about it. But we're now engineering financial coups by Twitter. We saw Egypt turn off the internet for 2 days. I suspect, that is going to be a losing proposition. But again, as I said, watch older leaders with commitments to the older constituencies get replaced by younger guys and have it all be done with the look of democracy. In the precious metals market, we see lots of support for gold and silver. It's been trying to correct, as I predicted at the beginning of the year, but it's not happening. They closed today, gold at $1,351, silver at $2,884. I still think there's a significant chance of a correction, but if I'm wrong, it's because too many people are looking to get out of the bond market and into something tangible. But more on that next week on precious metals. Under the food fascism category, the corruption accelerates. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced their decision once again to allow unlimited nationwide commercial planting of Monsanto's genetically engineered Roundup Ready alfalfa. This has enormous risks to organic and conventional farmers, and is really a warning to everyone that there's nothing more urgent than trying to find ways of really getting high quality food and protecting yourself from genetically modified food. Insight from a subscriber: they sent me a message about an investigation out in LA on farmers markets, and said, uh-oh, paving the way for federal regulation of farming markets, probably a pretty prescient comment. Just keep an eye on that, because that's going to be one of the leakages in the system they're going to want to control. There's a very interesting interview, and this under the category of by the way, with Dr. Judy Wood on Red Ice Creations. It's a radio show in Scandinavia that's has some quite good stuff on it. It's called Where Did the Towers Go? She's a material scientist, and she describes her theories about the kind of invisible weaponry that may have been used in 9/11. And it's just the kind of invisible weaponry I've been talking about is driving the value of the dollar and so much of the economic warfare we're watching. So for those of you who are trying to dig in and get information in that area, it's a good one. In the category of very, very, very good news, the Senate has passed a 1099 repeal amendment, which repeals the 1099 reporting requirements that were included in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We wrote a special report about them last year, talked about a fair amount, but it would require businesses to report to the IRS any purchase of goods and services over $600 a year. It's a paperwork creation act. I just can't tell you how many rainforests would have to get torn down for all of this. We saw this follows Obama announcing he's going to try and reduce regulatory burden on small business, which is a little bit like W.C. Fields saying that he sells snake oil potion to protect people from the snake he also carries around, or to justify his drinking. So Obama has delivered more regulatory burden on small business than any other president to date, and now he's talking about relieving it by repealing some that's passed under his watch. Our hero this week is a wonderful subscriber who always sends some great suggestions. He said in the cart, idea only, suggest subscribers retain locally the phone number and code to call for a regular Celeria report that might happen during an internet off period. Great idea. Don't forget to write down the number and the access code. We don't expect the internet to be switched off, but I assure you, if it is, we'll continue to have our phone calls. You can listen live on your browser, but you don't through Skype. You don't have to. We don't think it's needed, just because control is much more subtle in the United States and much more sort of ubiquitous than it is in a place like Egypt. But you never know. So write down that number and save it. It's a great suggestion. Okay, ask Catherine a few quick questions. Cliff High's latest report. A subscriber says on his latest report he thinks gold and silver will break out in spring and people will be sorry they didn't get on the bandwagon, but then he says the metal owners will have problems in the fall. What could that be possibly? we have an expression here in Tennessee, no telling, so it could be anything. I have no idea, and of course Cliff, when he maps out the psychic storm, will tell you he has no idea either, so I don't know, and it could be thousands of things, including the prices crashing and the dollar rising. Food book. I would like to know the name of a book to enlighten people on the deliberate poisoning of the food and land worldwide, the control of food worldwide, price rises, GMOs, etc. The best book I've found so far is Jeffrey Smith, Seeds of Deception, but there are more ones coming out every day. Something that looks really fantastic, Scientists Under Attack, Genetic Engineering and the Magnetic Field of Money. It's a documentary coming out in March. It's described as a documentary thriller about how agrochemical multinational corporations victimize international scientists to prevent them from publishing their scary findings. Some great descriptions of what's been happening to target the scientists who try to speak openly and honestly about genetically modified engineering of food. I put a link to the trailer up on the blog. You can find it there, and again, out in March. It looks really good. Ideas for helping our communities through collapse. I've brainstormed on helping my state to navigate the complete collapse of our system. It would be helpful to develop contingency plans and share ideas. In my opinion, the states with a best foresight communication plan and resources will come out the other end in better shape. And then could you do a Solari report on this? Paul Glover, the founder of Ithaca Hours, and just a wonderful guy in terms of coming up with real solutions for communities, has agreed he's going to do a Solari report, so we're trying to schedule that for the spring, and we hope that that is responsive. We have also scheduled in March Dr. Gwen Scott, who was a request from several subscribers. She has been, she's a naturopath nutritionist who's done some wonderful work on how to deal with some of the risks upon us, including chemtrails. Okay, so now the crash course with Chris Martinson. Chris Martinson is just a remarkable person. As I said, he's an internet sensation. He's a successful corporate executive and scientist who started to dig in and decide he really wanted to understand how the world worked, and ended up leaving his life as corporate scientist and an executive to become an entrepreneur, and among other things, publish a almost 4-hour video on the internet called The Crash Course, which is a review of what's going on in the economy, in energy, and in the environment, and why the future is going to be very different than the past, which has become just an incredible internet sensation, and really is a great and very very useful introduction to some of the resource and governance issues upon us. So it's a real pleasure, Chris, to welcome you to the Solari Report.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us your story of how you went from the big house and the big corporate job to publishing The Crash Course.
I wish I could tell you it was a plan that I had all perfectly worked out, but it was actually a bit of an accident. Somewhere around 2002, I became uncomfortable with what I was seeing in the world. And, you know, at this point, I'm completely on the American dream bandwagon, doing all the things I'm supposed to do. I've done lots of schooling and had lots of success. But I began digging around in the economy, and I was really shocked at what I found there. You know, I fell down a rabbit hole of data, and when I emerged, I realized that I had found some stuff that I really had to share. Now this was shocking stuff for me, where, you know, I've been through an MBA program, been a corporate executive, had a whole science background, and was shocked to discover that I hadn't learned somehow how money was made, for instance. You know, and that shouldn't be a shocking discovery. Any sixth grader could learn it. Any six-year-old could learn it. It's not technically hard, but it's mind-blowing when you finally learn it. And so, you know, so there were some shocks around how money was made, but then I learned about the actual debt levels of the country, and then I learned about the nature of how money and debt work together, and realized that there was nothing wrong with the story, the narrative of our country, as long as everything could continue to grow and expand forever. But as a scientist, immediately that set off alarm bells for me. And so what happened for me, long story short, is it became a mission of mine. My mission now is to create a world worth inheriting. And I think that it's true. I got three kids, but it's really important to me. And I think that begins with really assuring that we have the right national, maybe even global narrative running through our heads. And my assessment is that we're really badly off track at present, that we've got the wrong sorts of stories playing, and that this is an enormous risk to our futures.
Right. It's really funny. I always say to people, imagine driving to California with a map that's incorrect.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
That's what we're all doing. And I kind of think of the crash course as your way of giving everybody, you know, you're like the AAA of the real deal.
Yeah, and you know what the great part is? It's not like I've shown anybody a map that they didn't already know on some level was correct. Nobody said, oh my God, you've taught me stuff I've never known. They've always known it on some level, some intellectually, some through experience, some intuitively. But really what I've done is I've put all the dots into one spot so that we can actually have that material in one place. And when you put it in one spot, it's transformative. It has a huge impact. It had an enormous impact on my life. and on other people as well. So it's really not about discovering something that's really well hidden. We've always known it.
It's about integrating it together in a sort of action-oriented way, I think. Well, before we dive in and go through the key points, just give us a little feel of when you put it up and what happened then, what the response has been.
You know, I had it, it was a live seminar that I gave, and I became discomforted with the idea that I could only do this to 50, 60, 80, 100 people at a time. It just felt not really didn't have the scale I was looking for. So started putting it up on the internet. In the first chapter went up in March of 2008, and by October of 2008, it was completed, 20 chapters. And within that first year, when we got to October 2009, it had garnered what we suspect was around 1.5 million views, and had been translated into a couple languages by volunteers, which, when you think 3.5 hours of video, you understand what a...
That's a lot of translation.
What a task. Oh, my gosh. It's an enormous task. But people stepped up and did it, and it was... It should have been a disaster. It's PowerPoint slides, and I'm talking over it. There's, there's no live video of me. It's just a disaster, but... It had real, honest information, the best I could find, and I presented it with the least amount of my own burden attached to it, my own beliefs and opinions. I kept those as stripped out as I possibly could. Here it is. Here are the facts. And there was a real hunger for that, which really surprised me. I had no intention of having this become my livelihood or having it be as big as it was going to be, but it took off. I think there is a real hunger out there to just know what the diagnosis is, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. People just want to know. And,
well, the other thing is, you know, in 2008 with a financial crash, suddenly everybody's waking up. The hardest thing in the world is to look in the mirror and say, you know, I'm the patsy. And I think people, you know, what happened with the financial crash is they said, wait a minute, you know, the official reality is very different than reality, and I need to dig in and look. I need to look under the carpet. And so it seemed to me that Crash Course was a great place to do that.
Well, I've done what I possibly can to go forward and really expose things as well as I can. And I don't feel like I've discovered anything that hasn't already been discovered. What I've done is I've gone out and found really incredible material, translated it to as best I possibly can. That's my gift in the world. I can explain almost anything to anybody, and it's a lot of material. I mean, often people have said, "Oh, it's like an inconvenient truth." I'm like, no. Al Gore was trying to explain one thing, the connection between CO2 and temperature, one concept in an hour and a half. I'm running through a lot of concepts, and I wish there was a way to simplify it, make it even easier. But the truth is, it's a very complicated system we've got. Understanding it gives you insights, critical insights. If you can illuminate the path just a few steps before the next person can, you are in such an advantage in this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, yes, it's a lot of complicated material, but, I consider it the best work of my life. I worked extremely hard.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's the best work yet.
Yeah, the best yet.
More to come. Yeah. Okay, so walk us through, Chris, the key points in the Crash Course.
So the Crash Course walks through three biggies, actually four, but I talk about three biggies, those being the economy first, energy second, the environment third, the fourth E being exponential growth. If we put all those together, I can give my main conclusion in a single sentence. And it's that the next 20 years are going to be completely unlike the last 20 years. So that statement's now 3 years old. When I put that together, I was really putting it together in 2006 and 7. I think, inarguably, where we were in 2006 and 7 is completely different from where we are today. We are all down the rabbit hole. So I think that statement has really stood the test of time so far.
Right.
The big points around the economy are very simple. The economy has to grow. Not legally, there's no law, but structurally. And that's because of the miracle of the money system we've got involved with. It's a debt-based money system. All money is loaned into existence. It's a very simple statement with profound implications. As long as our money system is constantly growing, and not just growing, but growing exponentially, it's reasonably happy. So that's fine. You know, if it could grow infinitely forever, everything would be fine. As a scientist, you know, I know that's just a laughable statement.
Right.
So the next question we have to get to is, well, okay, what sort of threats or risks to growth might we see out there? Well, anything, everything in the universe grows because it has access to resources or energy. There's not an organism alive, there's not a system alive that can continually maintain its complexity, its beauty, its order without energy. And so I consider energy to be the master resource, as Julian Simon said. He was absolutely right. And so when we look at that master resource, you know, inarguably the most masterful of all fossil fuels within that category, oil. It's just, it's so magical what it does for us. Well, peak oil's here. It's a very real concept. It's not a theory. It's a description of a geological process. And we now know that conventional oil, at least, is in the rearview mirror in terms of its peak of production. And when we say conventional oil, well, that's a euphemism for cheap and easy. Right, like the Deepwater Horizon was us chasing not cheap, not easy oil. Right, so cheap and easy oil, though, those terms can really be more accurately described as high net energy, meaning we put a little bit of energy in, we get a whole lot back. Our net return is just glorious. The days of the high net energy oil and other energy sources is over, and we have to make do with less and less of that surplus, which means funding growth like we used to gets harder and harder. And so that's the really big story, where we connect an economy that must grow to an energy system that can't grow, must and can't. You know, there's a problem there. One of those two things will win. I'm a scientist, so I happen to think nature wins. This is a really, it's not like a looming problem. This is not something in the future. I mean, this is now. It's
right
happening
now.
Right now.
I have to confess, I'm a skeptic. Only because I think there's been so much suppression of, there's been a political decision to stay on the fossil fuel model and to keep lots of technology offline.
Well, and, even if that's true, and it could well be true. So let's go there for a second. Let's imagine that right now we have in a box, a magic box somewhere, a jar. And this jar can produce unlimited amounts of electricity. And so we say, great, all we have to do is open that jar and our energy problems are over. The problem is that history shows that transitioning from one form of energy to another, waiting for market force
right.
to do it, takes 4 to 6 decades.
Right.
Because there's all this embedded capital in the existing energy
right.
structure. So right now, tonight, somebody says, that's it, we're going to electric cars. You have to trash everything you own.
Right.
That runs on something other than electricity. And you're like, oh, my car, really? I got to, really? You know, it takes, you know, if we wait for market forces to give you the right signals to transition, you know, you're going to wait for your old capital to rust away or become obsolete and replace it on a natural cycle.
You know,
those cycles take decades.
When I was at Hamilton and we were prototyping sort of all different ways of re-engineering the economy with the new technology, I said to the smartest guy, I said, look, go out and figure how long it takes for new technology to go from big footprint to little footprint, you know, and why, and what can be done to accelerate. So he goes off and he comes back 2 weeks later. He says, it's going to take 50 years. I said, why is it going to take 50 years? He said, that's how long it takes for everybody to die. But, you know, but it was the same thing. You have it because your vested capital is not just your financial capital or your infrastructure. It's your intellectual capital. It's your way of doing things. It's, you know, what
yeah.
you know.
Social capital, institutional,
right.
all of those things. But they're all embedded, and they work a way, and we can change them, but we can never change them overnight.
Right,
and so,
exactly.
And so if 25, 30 years ago, if we'd had some fantastic alternative technology that's still hidden, that would have been the time to break it out.
Right.
Because we would have had the right couple of decades while oil was still on the upslope to have gone through a relatively smooth transition.
Right.
We can still transition, but I'll guarantee you it's going to be a lot less smooth.
It's much bumpier.
Should have been. Yeah.
It's much bumpier.
That's just where we are. We're in a bumpy ride now, and I don't think there's anything we can really do about that at this point. We made bad decisions 3 decades ago, so here we are.
Well, bad, depending on who you are. If you're, you know, some people thought it was really good.
Yeah. All right, so here's the punchline to that whole story, then, is that because we have declining net energy, but I'll use a different term, because we have declining cheap and easy energy at
right.
this point in time, I think growth as we've known it is no longer possible. And by growth, I mean where we're expecting the economy to do 3.3% per annum, where we want stocks to go up 10% in real returns, where we want bond funds to be able to infinitely grow larger and always return the principal and the interest payments in a tidy stream. I think that that story's over. And if that's over, it means that without growth, everything that we think we know about investing is suddenly wrong. Now, it doesn't mean we can't find out new ways to invest in all of that, but the old story of how we used to invest, I think, is over. And
there's
the people
one,
who can get there first, I think, have a better shot at maintaining their wealth.
There's one picture in the crash course that I just love because, you know, a picture really, you can say a lot with the right picture, but it's the miner sitting on top of, I think it's a copper nugget.
Yes. What a great picture.
Oh, my God. But you're talking about how easy it was to find a huge piece of copper, you know, when they started mining, as opposed to what it's like now. And if there's any picture, you know, I kind of call it peak everything. If there's one picture that describes the phenomenon of peak everything and how much harder it is to get, you know, an ounce of copper, boy, that picture says it all.
Yeah, and thank you. You brought me to the 30, which I hadn't quite gotten to, which is the environment, which for me is a story of resources, like in this case, where just 140, 50 years ago when that picture was taken, when we were first, you know, coming into the industrial age in full swing, we were still finding things like the picture you're describing is you know, it's a black and white picture from a long time ago, 1800 sometime. Couple guys are sitting on a copper nugget that's the size of a sofa. And it's sitting in a stream bed, you know? And guess what? We ran out of those really quick, and then we found slightly smaller ones, and then we're down to copper ores. And now in the North American continent, we're prosecuting ores that are 0.2%.
Wow.
There are a few small pockets that are still, you know, at 10%, but they're, you know, they're not really giant commercial-grade operations. And so that's just after 150 years. So what happens in the next 150 years of industrialization? The short answer is that without the energy that's implied in going after really dilute, ever more distant, deep, hard-to-find ore bodies, we're going to have a harder and harder time increasing the total amount of resources that we get. So guess what? We're going to transition to an economy that uses less resources, but nothing is geared for that. Not our financial system, not our political system, not our cultural system. We have the wrong stories in play. We're just not ready for it. We'll get there, but again, bumpy transition.
Right. It's one of the things you and I were talking about when earlier was that the right now to get financial growth, you need more consumption. Now, you can re-engineer the financial system so that the more you integrate new technology and reduce consumption, or you use intelligence and conservation and all these things, and you reduce consumption, you can engineer the financial system so you can get financial growth from that. But we haven't done it. We have mightily resisted it. And the whole corporate model now is not on optimizing place-based equity, but on optimizing, you know, corporate equity and production. So you know, you're exactly right. And the financial system is basically turning around and by shifting all the pension funds and different personal assets into the stock market, we're getting everybody deeply vested in more consumption.
Well, and we're making a very, I consider this to be financially reckless or imprudent. There's an enormous bet being made, which is that growth will be there. It's an implicit assumption. It's even explicit when you take a price-earnings ratio. It's explicitly baked into that growth, right? We're planning on growth. And I think that there's enough evidence out there now, enough data. I'm not asking people to, like, believe me, I've got the absolute right story, but there's enough data that I think reasonable, prudent adults and certainly people who are in positions of financial authority ought to be asking the question, what if? What if it turns out that all of our primary assumptions are now upended, wrong, no longer applicable, changed? We have enough data now that it's not like we're talking about something that might happen in 20 years. Conventional oil is now in the rearview mirror. We know this to be true.
It's very interesting. I wrote a letter to the New York Times, which is up on the web, in 1998, and it was about the prison stocks. We were in a sort of a period when prison companies were being formed and going public, and their stocks were trading based on how many people they had in their beds. So the stock traded on a per-bed basis. And the more beds you got, and if you passed laws that would increase the number of beds, then your stock would go up. And if you looked at this, at the prison stocks, and you broke it down to a place-based basis for North America, and you looked at the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and home building stocks, there was no way both could be true. One was assuming all these people went to jail, and the other was assuming they were refinancing their mortgage and going down to Home Depot. And they couldn't be in both places. I used to say, look, these prisoners are going to have to refinance their home 2 and 3 times a year from jail for this to all work. But there was no cross-cutting portfolio strategy to look at the fundamental assumptions behind all these different price levels in things that didn't necessarily look connected until you started squeezing down on the Pillsbury Doughboy. And I could never understand why the pension, the institutional investors weren't doing that kind of strategic analysis.
You know, those institutional investors, given the amount of money that they have at risk and in play at all times, they've really surprised me a lot. I mean, look, they've been taken to the cleaners by high-frequency trading. They've been taken to the cleaners by – I mean, your Wall Street is just there to take their pennies off of every transaction.
Right.
And it's
They're
not
being
possible.
Trained.
Yeah, you can't constantly skim from a game and have everybody be a winner. It's just, you know, something has never worked in that model at any point in time.
Well, it's worked for the criminals. Don't be ridiculous.
No. It can't work for everybody, though. It's worked for them beautifully. And I think everybody was willing to go along with it as long as the pie was expanding.
Right.
And that pie expanded for a long time. And we're now in a non-expansionary phase. And it's interesting. The model I have is I'm watching media, Wall Street, participants, individuals, pension funds, they're all grappling with it. They can't get their heads around the idea that the game has changed, that
right.
There's no longer enough for everybody to skim a little and everybody to get wealthy. Now it's a zero-sum game with losers and winners, and we're
right.
seeing clearly who the losers and winners are here. It couldn't be clearer than the $135 billion that Wall Street just took home, while the states are basically short about a similar amount and looking to make similar size cuts. I mean, it's just completely obvious.
Now, I have this mythic character who I call Mr. Global, and Mr. Global is, you know, when you go up, up, up in the centralization of the economy, you go to the very top of the investment and financial system, there's a mythic character named Mr. Global who's sort of looking at the data and making decisions. And what I wanted to talk about, because clearly Mr. Global saw the crash course before you published it, and I don't mean saw your version of it, they saw the handwriting on the wall. So there's nothing that you're looking at that Mr. Global hasn't been looking at. And my question to you is, do you think that the phenomena that you're looking at is what is can explain Mr. Global's behavior? In other words, the leadership is clearly behaving very differently than they're talking. And the question is, are they behaving this way because they see the handwriting on the wall and they're responding to basically the information you've now made accessible to everybody?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think I have to answer it in a couple of different ways, one within the United States, one from outside the United States. Within the United States, I differentiate between the political structure that's what we would call institutional. These are career people, right? They're working within HUD, where you worked for a period of time, or they're working within the Department of Energy. You know, they're there for 20, 30, 40 years.
Uh-huh.
And the people who get politically rotated in and out, they're more of a transitory crowd. They're the ones we pay attention to and all of that. But within the embedded structure, we've seen that the Department of Defense is very clearly aware of peak oil. In fact, they've tossed up their hands and decided that they can't no longer wait for the civilian side of government to come to the right conclusion. So there are parts of the government that have understood and have been preparing for and are being very methodical about the longer-term risks that they see. The people who get elected in and out, who knows what's going on with them, but I have very little faith in their particular ability to see stuff. Outside of the United States, China is very clearly on the resource game. If they're not, their actions are mysterious because their actions are perfectly aligned with a country that sees the importance of resources, the primacy of them, and the dwindling aspect and potential future scarcity. And they are behaving in a way that is wholly consistent with how if I was autocratic leader for the day of 1.3 billion people, I would be doing exactly what China is doing.
Right. You'd be converting your dollars into tangible strategic positions all around the world, which is exactly
they bought land, arable land in Africa. They've bought, you know, copper resources in Afghanistan, oil from every continent you can possibly name, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, they're really, they're doing, and they haven't just started it last week. They've been doing this for 5 or 6 years now in a very open way. I think that's what they're doing. If I got to put my magic hat on and I was Mr. Global and I did see these things that I see, I would be trying to do more or less some of the things that China is doing, but I would do a couple. I would flip things a little bit. The step one I would take, first thing, I would try and have everybody, as many people who were important, get on board with this idea. We need to have a very clear assessment of the actual nature of the predicament we face. Not what we wish it to be or hope it to be or any of that, but what it really is. And before we can prescribe any solutions, I think we have to diagnose accurately the condition we're facing. Once we did that, I'm reasonably comfortable we'd say, wow, we have a pretty big mismatch between our resource requirements and our money system. And so step two is I would immediately begin a process of stewarding our remaining energy resources in particular, but other ones as well, in the most clever, useful ways possible. I'm not saying don't use them, but just let's use them wisely.
Right.
For instance, you know, I've heard a lot that we have a lot of natural gas. There's all the shale plays, and apparently we've got a ton of natural gas, and people are emboldened by that, thinking our energy crisis is solved in some respect. Not until we can figure out how to get that gas to market, right? So if we're going to do that transition, and we're going to use the natural gas to transition through this period, the cars have to be retrofitted. We need new cars built that can run on the natural gas. Filling stations have to be retrofitted and or built anew. New pipeline storage facilities. Yeah, there's a huge infrastructure play there that has to happen before we can reasonably expect to use that resource.
Right, and it can have profound impacts on our water supply.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's no technology comes without its flip side of the coin. There's always something to learn there. Food. Let's say we're very concerned about food going out to 2050 or something like that. Well, we need to conserve and begin rebuilding our topsoil right away. No more building on productive farmland. We're stopping that right away. And then we have to begin the really long process of figuring out how to loop our nutrients back into the soils rather than flushing them uselessly and somewhat harmfully
right,
out into the ocean.
The rebuilding of the soil is an enormous issue, but if you look at the way industrial agriculture is going, it's going at the opposite direction.
It is. The trend is still unfavorable in that direction, but if the question was, can I be Mr. Global and snap my fingers and say, here's what we're going to do, I would immediately begin thinking about our food, our water, our fuel. Bang. Right at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's huge changes we need to do there. And here's the great thing. We don't need any new technology discovered. There are people who already know what the right things are to do.
Right.
We have all the information we need. We know how to farm appropriately. We already have that information. We know how to conserve energy so that we can transition. We already know how to use stuff more efficiently. But we're not doing it.
Right.
And
when you say Mr. Global decides, you know, our, the question is, who's our? In other words, you're talking about what you would do if you were watching out for everybody.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
You know, so one possibility is Mr. Global has said, this is a very tricky situation. I've got to make sure to watch out just for us.
Well, maybe that's sort of a historical lesson. I was kind of speaking as a benevolent, like if Mr. Global was actually going to try and
you're going to be
stuff.
A different kind of Mr. Global.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, maybe I went off reservation there. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We need to reinvent Mr. Global. You know, we need to create a picture that Mr. Global can shift into that's, you know, where he's a hero. That's a good thing.
Well, two-prong answer then. Prong one. I can see a future that we can step into if we choose to do it, where there is hope, where there are solutions, where there are things we can do. I'm not saying that, you know, if we do that, it's all rainbows and unicorns and everybody's happy. There's still some hard slogging to go there, but there's a direction we can go where there are real positive things we can do.
Right. Change can be fun.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's have a major national or international program that demonstrates real and enormous support for new energy-related technologies.
Right.
Related to every step of energy transformation from, you know, the whole spectrum from generation to final use, right?
Uh-huh.
And here's my target. The world has to spend a larger amount on that than they currently do on military expenditures to demonstrate that it's a priority.
Think about what $1 trillion a year could do.
It could do a lot. I mean,
it could do a huge amount. I mean, it's, once you sit down and you look at the numbers of what we're spending to control everybody and everything, what you realize is, you know, an out-of-control world could be pretty economic.
There's a lot we could do. So, but then prong two. What's likely to happen? What's realistic? What do I personally assess is going to happen? The reason that I spend so much time working with people, asking them, helping them, cajoling them, anything I can do to help them begin to undertake preparations is based on my fairly deep-seated belief that it is very unlikely that benevolent Mr. Global is going to show up, and that what we're going to do is what history has suggested we always do, which is the status quo will do everything it can to preserve its power and status, and that this means that the most likely outcome is that we just stumble into the next crisis. And it's my view that the next crisis is not going to be a very pleasant one, simply because we're going to have a lot less, you know, when we stumbled in the 70s, Jimmy Carter puts on the cardigan, we had a geopolitical energy crisis. Guess what? We could stumble through that, and we still had tons of energy, other resources. There were other things we could do. We could, you know, Paul Volcker could ram interest rates up to 21%. The world could survive those shocks because we still had buffers in the system that we have now narrowed them down. We've skinnied them down that I don't personally see where the buffers are. We just don't have them in our food supply system, our energy supply system, our monetary systems. So I don't think we could take that kind of shock again without disruptions.
My concept of the economy is a slow burn, and basically that what the insiders are doing in currency debasement is a very important part of this. They print money and basically give it to themselves while the debasement then squeezes everybody else. So they're basically composting the outsiders and the outsiders' assets to keep themselves flush, and it's working. I mean, you know, in terms of protecting them, it's absolutely working. They print more paper to cover the higher expenses that comes from printing more paper.
Yeah, seniorage is an incredible privilege, maybe the most exorbitant one of them all. But my view, you know, there's a couple of ways that key ways that I sort of look at the world, and one of them is embodied in the idea that our economy, and I'm going to say global at this point, but it could be the national U.S. economy, it's a complex system. And like any complex system, it has more moving parts than any one person can understand. There's things that can be done to influence and manipulate it, but control it ultimately? It's a complex system. And my view of complex systems is this: you can never predict exactly what's going to happen and when. And so a view I hold is that when things do shift, they tend to shift a lot faster. They unravel faster. They shift to a new point of equilibrium for a while, much quicker than most people believe could happen or
understand.
Right,
it's building, and suddenly, wham.
Wham. You look at Egypt. I mean, everything 3 weeks ago, Egypt's fine. Mubarak is, like, undeniably in power, and now he's not. There's some question about how that's all going to turn out now. And that unraveled relatively quickly, but that's the nature of systems like this. Everything's fine, and then it's not. And that's been absolutely true all the way through this financial crisis. And the really hard part for myself, and I think it's true for other people, is to not get caught in that shifting baseline, where as things steadily get a little, you know, worse a long time, you start to make sense of that in your own head, such that when it shifts a lot, all of a sudden you're just caught unawares. Where if you can hold if you cannot have your baseline shift all the way through this. So here's an example. I follow the Fed really closely. It's embarrassing how closely I follow what they do. 3 years ago, I was shocked when they did their first monthly POMO that cracked $8 billion. It was in January, and they'd done this, you know, money printing operation. I was like, $8 billion? Oh, man, the Internet, you know, in my small corner of it was alive with this. It was just what a shocking story. Well, now they do stuff a whole order and a half magnitude higher than that, and I'm numb. I look at it, I go, oh, okay, you know, what did they do? Oh, it was $110 billion this month. Well, okay, you know. It's a shifting baseline. If they did $110 billion POMO 3 years ago, I would have absolutely gone into high gear and just like been action man, you know, because it would have really scared me. But here we are, and it's really amazing to me that we're here at a place where the Federal Reserve is now essentially, in every given month, printing up the equivalent of, what do we have, maybe $700 billion in total corporate
right.
U.S. profits in the S&P? So right. they're basically printing up one-seventh of the entire profitability of every productive enterprise, you know, in the top 500 companies in America every month, out of thin air.
Now, we just got a question that relates to something I covered in Money and Market, but in fact, it dovetails right back into the crash course, and then I want to talk about your workshop. So let me bring it in as a segue. Now that Social Security is actually in the red, how will the economic collapse impact Social Security in the near future? Will the right use the situation to scrap the program altogether? Now, one of the hardest things I find people grappling with when they try and contemplate change is, will my Social Security be there?
No. The answer is no. And the reason why is very simple. One of the things that most people have to get past is a lot of the misinformation that's been programmed out there, which says that there's such a thing as a Social Security trust fund, implying that there's funds in a trust somewhere, but there aren't. What
right.
there are is one arm of the government having already spent another arm of the government's money, and that first arm is called the General Obligation Fund that the Congress controls, and the second arm is the Social Security Trust Fund. It's not, you know, Enron characters went to prison for doing exactly the same kind of accounting that goes on in the Social Security system, which is that one body of the same institution owes money to another body, and it's counted as an asset. You can't do that. So once we cancel the asset and the liability out, it turns out there's zero money in the trust fund. That's part one. Part two is to understand that the trust fund itself does not represent a true debt of the U.S. government. It's a liability, and that liability is subject to revision. It can be written away at the stroke of a pen. Yes, you receive these things in the mail, which seem a little fraudulent to me, where you get this, I get Social Security statements, like a statement,
right.
like it's a bank statement. You open up
right.
the envelope, and you flip it open. There's your name. There's your earning history. And you look at it, and it says, this is your inputs, right?
Right.
It feels fraudulent to me because what's not mentioned in that piece of paper is the fact that any given Congress, it could be this year's Congress or the one in 3 years or in 10 years, it doesn't matter, could come forward and write an act that would make that piece of paper put your claim to zero. And so that's the difference between a liability and a debt. A debt's a legal obligation. A liability is more of a moral obligation.
Right.
The question when we're asking ourselves, how comfortable do I feel about my right ownership or likelihood to get Social Security from the federal government is how moral is Congress?
Right. Right.
Right. They'll be moral as long as they can be, and then they won't be if circumstances. I can easily foresee deep fiscal crises as we go forward. So the most probable answer, though, is it doesn't go away for everybody. What happens is they're going to come up
it.
With some complicated thing.
Yeah, you debase
and,
it over time. And
people who are currently retired will probably get most back out. People who are in their 30s now are paying into a system they'll probably never see a dime from, would be my guess.
So it'll be the long and agonizing wind down.
Yes.
Let's talk. I was really struck by the fact that a lot of what you're doing in terms, you know, sort of your business and entrepreneurship, is helping people deal with the emotional side effects of sort of coming to grips with the information in the crash course. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about that and the importance of working through the emotions, and then tell us a little bit more about the workshop that's coming up.
Thank you for that question. The most important thing that my work and the work of the people in my team, we exist to help people become more prepared. And so it's fairly easy for people when they first come in contact with this information to do some levels of preparation. They could be financial, they could be physical in nature, and those are perfectly appropriate. Absolutely, I'm in high support of any actions anybody wants to take. But ultimately, it once you get through some of the earlier, easier parts, the most important preparations you can make are actually emotional. And by that I mean when it's a well-known fact that when people are full of fear or anxiety, their ability to make good decisions is severely compromised. We're going to be coming into some fairly stressful periods of time. And so being emotionally prepared is really critically important. And the work that I do online, you know, so I write a lot about topics around the economy, around energy, the environment, helping people understand what's happening. I do a lot of information scouting. But the work I'm most proud of is when we have our we have seminars where people can come, and we'll get 50, 70, 80 people in a room, and we'll have the whole weekend at a fairly private place. And what we'll do there is we are really going to work through understanding if the crash course is this big tour through this left brain, we're going to go over and spend some time on the right side of the brain, which is understanding what do we really need to be the best prepared we can as we go forward. What does it mean to be in community? How do I talk to loved ones, partners, spouses, colleagues, people I meet on the street about this really important material?
Especially if they don't want to hear about it.
Especially if they don't want to hear about that. And so we've got a whole model for how you can detect where people are in that spectrum. And guess what? Some people, you can ask them a couple of questions and find out that they are not people you should be spending any time talking to because you're going to piss both of you off, right?
Right.
And so we have a structured way of working through that material. And so this next, we do one big seminar like this every year. This next one's coming up on February 25th, which is a Friday, through the 27th, which is a Sunday. It's going to be at the Rowe Conference Center in Rowe, Massachusetts. And if anybody wanted to find it, you could go to rowcenter.org is the website of the facility where we'll be holding this. And they manage all of the details. So there's still some spaces available there for this weekend coming up. And it's just a fabulous time to honestly, one of the best things that happens there, I could disappear. My wife, who's another facilitator there, could disappear. The same 50, 70 people could show up, and it's just magic watching what happens when people who are fully immersed in this material, who know that change is coming, get an opportunity to just talk with each other.
Right.
Every year we have business
owners. To be with
owners,
like-minded people where you don't have to be careful, you can be forthright, it's really fun.
You can say exactly what's on your mind, and these are just ordinary but usually fairly successful people, business owners, lawyers, doctors, and everybody, you know, all sorts of people, very successful people who've just come to the conclusion, wow, there's something happening, and I want to be as prepared as I can be. So it's just a fun weekend.
Well, give us just 30 seconds on how we can stay current on your website. How do we stay up on what Chris is doing?
Well, you can go. My website is chrismartenson.com. Last name is MartenSon.com. And there's all kinds of material there. We've got this incredible series called What Should I Do?, covering everything from beekeeping to being resilient to, you know, making fires out of sticks to, you know, financial things. And all of those are written by subscribers and members of our web community. And then I also do write a series of reports, fairly routine, fairly regular, on topics around the three E's, around what I see coming. And really the key value I add there is I'm an information scout. I'm just trying to figure out how can I illuminate the path 1, 2, 3 months ahead so that we can see what's happening. I let the data do the talking. I am not afraid to change my opinion when the data changes. And we have a very strong commitment to being just current, abreast, and as honest as we can be with what we see going on. And it's been fairly successful for us, and we've got just a wonderful community.
Well, Chris, thank you for joining us on the Solaire Report. It's been a pleasure. I just want to tell everybody again, the crash course is our Let's Go to the Movies movie this week, and you can start the introduction on the blog post or just go to Chris's website. It's all there. If you don't have time to take the full course, there's a 45-minute introductory, and I just recommend it to you. It's a wealth of great data, and it's a great service, Chris. So thank you again for everything you're doing.
And thank you as well.
Okay, that's it. Next week, we have Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. As I promised one subscriber, I'm going to try and pry a silver outlook out of Franklin and me. I've given you the gold, but we'll look for the silver. February 17th, Stuart Thompson, the bankster mine. He used to be a broker at Merrill Lynch and has got a lot of insight into the economic warfare games we're having to, you know, that are going on the market while we're trying to navigate our assets through into a good place. Then first week in March, Blake Levitt, an attorney top expert on electromagnetic pollution, including cell towers, just a marvelous research. And as you know, I'm very concerned about how to protect ourselves and our family against that kind of pollution. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. And just remember, as we go forward with the kind of change Chris is talking about, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.